Hey everyone, this is Jeff, otherwise known as Brendan Beefish. I haven't done this in a really long time, but I'm going to try to record an old essay series that I wrote a really long time ago. Well, not that long ago, but I wrote it back in 2014 on the Battle of Fire. The reason why I'm recording this essay series now is because, one, I'm interested in the topic, and I think it's a fascinating topic and something that'll be major influence and interest in the Winds of Winter. And secondly, Radio Westeros had released a lovely episode that they invited me on, called The Battle of Fire, A Red Dawn, which is a really cool episode. If you guys have a chance to pick it up, go ahead and do that. They did something really interesting in that one. They had, it be a radio theater slash news program of live events from the Battle of Fire with, Yoggboy, Lady Gwyn, and I acting different parts in the series. It was really cool, so you guys go check it out. I might link to it in some of the old essay series. I'll at least link to it in the description box for this episode. So with that in mind, I figured it'd be cool to talk a little bit about the Battle of Fire and to return to that essay series. My intent is I'm going to record all six parts. I'm going to chop it individually and post them with the essays themselves. And I'm going to release the entire thing as a podcast episode, so it'll probably be about 2.5, 3 hours. We'll see after I'm done recording it. So, again, thank you very much for listening and for originally reading the series. And just sit back, relax, enjoy, and this is A Dragon Dawn, a complete analysis of the Battle of Fire. Administrative note: this recording is going to contain some spoilers for the Winds of Winter. Martin has released a number of Winds of Winter sample chapters, and of the sample chapters he's released, five of them have been about the Battle of Fire. So it is something that Martin is invested in, and it is something that I delve into in this recording and in the original essay series. So if you're looking to enter the Winds of Winter spoiler-free, no worries. I won't judge you. Towards the end of this recording, there will be significant Winds of Winter spoilers. Probably the first hour and a half or so will not have those types of spoilers. At the end of A Storm of Swords, Daenerys Targaryen stood as the unrivaled master of Slaver's Bay. Her sack of Astapor, defeat of Yunkai, and conquest of Meereen vaulted her and her band of followers to positions of hegemony over the region. However, in A Dance with Dragons, things began to fall apart. Plagued by a homegrown insurgency in Meereen, her situation was only worsened by the arrival of Plague and a resurgent Yunkai. Surrounded by Yunkai and its allies, and beset with Plague, Daenerys' arc was building to a great battle, the Battle of Fire. About 2 years ago, I wrote an essay series on Daenerys' campaign in Slaver's Bay. In that essay, I detailed how Dany acquired her army and started a war of liberation in Slaver's Bay. When she finally arrived in Meereen, Daenerys made a fateful decision. She would remain in Meereen and learn how to rule. But her rule of Meereen would be contested by internal and external forces. And this conflict was building to a great battle. Again, about 2 years ago, I wrote a two-part series on the upcoming Siege of Winterfell. The Battle of Fire, or the Battle of Slaver's Bay, or the Battle of Meereen, will be the second battle to open the Winds of Winter. Shortly after the publication of A Dance with Dragons, George R. R. Martin was asked what he had in store for the Winds of Winter. He said, quote, "I'm going to open the Winds of Winter with two big battles that I was building up to, the Battle of Ice and the Battle of Slaver's Bay, and then take it from there." In this series and recording, I'll analyze and speculate how the Battle of Fire will transpire. Parts 1 to 4 will primarily be a summary and analysis of events from A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons. Part 5 will be an in-depth look at each side of the eve of battle, and look at how each faction, Barristan and Meereen, Yunkai and her allies, and Victarion and the Iron Fleet, are preparing to win the battle. Towards the end of this recording, I'll finally delve into the battle itself, utilizing released and read sample chapters from The Winds of Winter. I'll close part 6 with speculation on who will win the battle, who will lay dead in the field, and what the outcome will mean for the future of Meereen and Daenerys' arc. And while this essay series will touch on the motivations and inner character conflict within each of the major characters in the series, this will primarily be political and military analysis. To get into the character conflict rife with Daenerys, Barristan, and others, I strongly encourage you all to read Adam Felman's Marinese Blot, particularly his essays on Daenerys, as they really touch on the character conflict with Dany and the other characters wound into the Marinese knot. All right, let's now move into Daenerys Targaryen, Slaver's Bay, and kind of everything that's moving towards the Battle of Fire. After Storm of Swords, Daenerys Targaryen stood triumphant over the city of Meereen. She fashioned herself a conqueror in the vein of Aegon the Conqueror. But much as the Americans found in Iraq, the initial glory would be quick to fade. The conquest, by all accounts, was the easy part. The hard part was ruling. Dany's major rationale in seizing Meereen was moral. She would take the city in order to end the blight of slavery. Slavery was evil, but it was also profitable and ingrained into thousands of years of Meereenese culture. Dany's quest to end slavery would meet opposition, and not all of it would be peaceful. Dany's first step in Meereen was to secure the city. The initial assault on Meereen had seen some of the city come under a wave of pillaging and sacking. Quote, Meereen had been sacked savagely after its fall. The step pyramids of the mighty had been spared the worst of the ravages, but the humbler parts of the city had been given over to an orgy of looting and killing as the city's slaves rose up and the starving hordes who had followed her from Yunkai to Astapor poured through the broken gates. A Dance of Dragons, Daenerys 1. When the slaves rose up and started looting and killing the nobility of Meereen, the Unsullied responded and secured the quadrants of the city rising against the nobility. The Unsullied were a heavy infantry force who were all eunuchs. Daenerys had acquired them in Astapor and then ordered her new soldiers to sack the city. The Unsullied had been instrumental in defeating Yunkai the first time and then breaching the walls of Meereen. The primary weapon of the Unsullied was the long spear. Led by a former slave who went by the name of Grey Worm, the Unsullied were the preeminent fighting force in Slaver's Bay. Daenerys had about 8,000 Unsullied under her command in Meereen. Daenerys also had two sellsword companies under her command. The Stormcrows were a force of about 500 soldiers, mostly mounted. Their leader was a flamboyant man by the name of Daario Naharis. Under Daario, his subordinate commanders, who will be important later on, were named the Widower and Jokin. The second sellsword company that Daenerys had was the Second Sons. Led by Brown Ben Plum, the Second Sons numbered about 500 soldiers as well. Both sellsword companies had previously stood opposite Daenerys in her campaign in Slaver's Bay, but both had come to Dany's side, meaning their loyalty to Dany's cause was uncertain. But though the loyalty of Brown Ben Plum and Daario Naharis may have been questionable, Daenerys did have one stalwart military commander under her command, Sir Barristan Selmy. Sir Grandfather, as he was known to his soldiers, was a renowned member of the King's Guard. He had joined Daenerys' cause shortly after her departure from Carth. Posing as his elderly squire, Barristan evaluated Daenerys to determine if she was as mad as some of her Targaryen ancestors. After determining her sanity and saving her life, Barristan revealed himself to Daenerys. Dany was initially reluctant to trust Barristan, so she sent him on a near-suicide mission through the sewers of Meereen with Jorah Mormont. When the Old Knight emerged alive from the battle, Daenerys offered forgiveness and service to the Old Knight. The final and most important thing that Daenerys had was three dragons. Dragons were Dany's force multiplier. They could destroy a much larger army, and they were nigh invulnerable to any weapon of man. However, dragons were also a double-edged sword. While they could sow mass destruction on Daenerys' enemies or potentially deter her enemies from marching on her, they were not peaceful creatures. Here's something that George said about them. Quote, dragons are the nuclear deterrent, and only Dany has them, which in some cases makes her the most powerful person in the world. But is that sufficient? These are the kinds of issues I'm trying to explore. Unquote. If Dany were to learn how to rule Meereen peacefully, her dragons would serve as visible symbols of her violent past and potentially stumbling blocks for a future peaceful Meereen. But despite the hosts and dragons that Daenerys brought into Meereen, the security situation was fluid. Opposition to her rule, led by the noble families of Meereen, would spring up partially as a result of Dany's moral crusade, but it also came as a result of Dany's actions in the immediate aftermath of the conquest of Meereen. As I've talked about previously, one of the first actions that Daenerys took after conquering the city was to crucify 163 members of the Great Masters of Meereen, the ruling families of the city. Subsequently, armed resistance to Dany and those who supported her arose in Meereen. The resistance became known as the Sons of the Harpy. It would be easy to look at this insurgency as a force for evil, but it would do a disservice to its complexity. There was an element of reversing Dany's ban on slavery and slave trading in Meereen in their motivations, but it wasn't because they were necessarily monsters. Their livelihood had depended on the trade. Daenerys had, in my opinion, rightly destroyed the economic fiber of Meereen, but if Meereen wasn't in the slave trading business, what economic outputs would they have? It's something that Hisdarzo Lorik talks about when he's talking about Dany. Quote, without slaves, Meereen had nothing to offer traders. Copper was plentiful in the Skari Hills, but the metal was not as valuable as it had once been when bronze ruled the world. The cedars had grown tall along the coast, grew no more, fell by the axes of the old empire, are consumed by dragonfire when geese made war against Valyria. Once the trees had gone, the soil baked beneath the hot sun and blew away in a thick red cloud. A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 3. With their livelihood taken away from them, Dany's actions in crucifying the 163 nobles was a clarion call to the great masters that their livelihood, and more importantly, their lives were at stake. But the Sons of the Harpy had other reasons to violently resist Daenerys. When Dany assumed rulership of Meereen, she had closed the great fighting pits of the city. The fighting pits of Meereen were the city's prime source of entertainment, where spectators would watch slaves fight. Much like the Roman gladiatorial matches, the fighting pits of Meereen were very popular with the city's inhabitants. When Daenerys closed the pits, she essentially stated that not only was she a threat to the lives and livelihoods of the Meereenese, but she was also a threat to their way of life. Daenerys, for her part, didn't view it in this light. The moral outrage of slavery demanded its end. The crucifixion of the slave children against every milepost from Yunkai to Meereen demanded a harsh tribute of justice, no matter if it was indiscriminate. And the fighting pits were a moral outrage that needed to be ended. To her, the Sons of the Harpy were an evil, shadowy force stuck in the past. Quote, "Somewhere beneath those roofs, the Sons of the Harpy were gathered, plotting ways to kill her and all those who loved her, and put her children back in the chains." A Dance of Dragons, Daenerys 2. They may have been planning that, but they were also looking to survive, and likely viewed Dany not as a liberator, but as a tyrant. Now, transitioning from Meereen to another city, let's talk a little bit about Astapor. Of all the suffering endured by various places in A Song of Ice and Fire, Astapor could well be the one location to have suffered the most. Originally a slaving city renowned for its production of Unsullied, Astapor saw the start of Daenerys' campaign in Slaver's Bay when she sacked the city in retaliation for its barbaric slave trading practices. Just before she burned the city, Daenerys fraudulently negotiated with its great masters to purchase all of the Unsullied. Now, Dany never intended to settle down in Astapor, so she left shortly after the city's sack. But even though she didn't plan to stay, she wanted Astapor to adhere to her moral standards, and also to refrain from any reprisal against her and her followers. So, she appointed a council to rule the city in her stead. However, Daenerys seemed to be more interested in the next stages of her campaign in Slaver's Bay than what happened in Astapor. Thus, she didn't leave a security force in place of perhaps Unsullied, or even giving instructions that Astapor should raise its own army. As we'll see, this action would prove to be one of her most costly mistakes. Subsequently, a few weeks after Dany's departure from Astapor, her council ran into the machinations of a man named Cleon. Cleon had previously been a butcher for one of the noblemen of Astapor, and reportedly could butcher a pig faster than any butcher in the city. Cleon's ambitions didn't end with being the faster butcher in the city, however. He wanted power, and Daenerys' council stood in his way. So Cleon riled the former slaves up with a tale of how the council was conspiring to re-enslave the people of Astapor. The fate of Dany's council could have been written on walls. They were violently deposed and executed. And once you know it, Cleon rose to become the new king of Astapor. Where Daenerys' original council was comprised of people who she had hoped would lead the city peacefully and wisely, Cleon was cut from a different cloth. His first action after having the council executed was to dispatch an envoy to Daenerys to propose marriage. Cleon was taking a look at his crystal ball, and what he saw coming from Yunkai troubled him. He needed Dany, her army, and her dragons to stand as allies against the Yunkai. Dany, of course, refused Cleon's offer and gave instructions for Cleon not to get involved in conflict with the Yunkai. But Cleon believed war with Yunkai to be unavoidable. To counter Yunkai, he needed good soldiers, but if none were available, he would make do with whatever he had, no matter the heinousness of producing them. Quote, "King Cleaver's thugs had seized every highborn boy in Astapor to make new Unsullied for the trade, though it will be years before they are trained." The Storm of Swords, Daenerys 6. So with no food in the markets and no slaves to sell, Cleon discarded Daenerys' anti-slavery prohibition. Though ostensibly raised to the purple to keep Astapor slave-free, Cleon either wasn't personally opposed to slavery, or was a realist. Astapor's economy had been slave-based for thousands of years. When Dany sacked the city, she cut out the city's economic heart. So Cleon likely reinstituted slavery to keep the city afloat. But Cleon couldn't re-enslave the people who had brought him to power, so Cleon became an instrument of vengeance for those formerly oppressed. Quote, "Cleon, the self-styled great, was no better, however. The Butcher King had restored slavery to Astapor, the only change being that the former slaves were now the masters, and the former masters were now the slaves." A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 1. Cleon's actions ran against Daenerys' aims in Slaver's Bay, and as we'll see, his actions would be part and parcel of his undoing. So let's take a moment to go far away from Slaver's Bay to a place maybe 10,000 miles away from it, and talk about the Iron Islands. Far away from Slaver's Bay, the Ironborn were rising. The Ironborn were a warlike people who had come from the sparsely populated Iron Islands west of the continent of Westeros. The history of the Ironborn was intertwined with their warrior caste culture. Honor, booty, and captives were earned through war. Originally an independent kingdom whose holdings extended into the Riverlands and even the Crownlands, what became known as the Crownlands of Westeros, the Ironborn were subjugated by Aegon the Conqueror during his conquest of Westeros. 283 years after Aegon's landing, the Ironborn, under the command of Lord Balon Greyjoy, rose up in rebellion against the Iron Throne. This insurrection, known as the Greyjoy Rebellion, proved badly unsuccessful when the whole of Westeros responded militarily and crushed the rebellion. But though the Greyjoy Rebellion had been an all-around disaster, the Ironborn dreamed of its independence and returned to its reaving ways. When the War of the Five Kings erupted in mainland Westeros, as a result of a lot of familiar reasons that you guys are probably all well familiar with, the Ironborn stayed out of the conflict initially. However, when Balon Greyjoy's heir was returned to Pyke, Balon Greyjoy, then still Lord of the Iron Islands, sensed an opportunity and ordered his fleet to attack the North and seize its lands and incomes while its army was away. The invasion was devastating to the North. The Ironborn struck out from the Iron Islands and seized key castles and towns across the North. The few Northern soldiers left behind were unable to throw back the Ironborn raiders into the sea. The Ironborn invasion of the North proved to be one of the many factors which doomed the North's desire for independence. But though the Ironborn invasion would be successful in its inception, its long-term success in the North would prove less than durable. The most important piece to unravel was the King of the Iron Islands himself, Balon Greyjoy. Balon Greyjoy mysteriously died while attempting to cross a bridge on Pyke. The very next day, Euron Greyjoy, his brother, sailed into Pyke. A King's Moot was called. The King's Moot was an event where every Ironborn captain voted on who would be the next king of the Iron Islands. This event was rare and only occurred if there was no trueborn son to serve as heir to the dead king. In this case, Balon's last surviving son, Theon, was believed dead. In the end, there were only two men who had a real chance to succeed him, his brothers Euron and Victarion Greyjoy. Now, Euron was the second son of Lord Quellyn Greyjoy. When Balon Greyjoy declared himself King of the Iron Islands, it was Euron Greyjoy who developed the plan to strike the Lannister fleet at Lannisport. Euron was banished by Balon Greyjoy after he allegedly raped the wife of his brother Victarion. While abroad, Euron had reaved and raped his way across the seas. He reportedly sailed to Ishai in the Smoking Seas and around Valyria. Regarded as mad by many, Euron Greyjoy had plans for the Ironborn that went well past the North. Now, Victarion Greyjoy was the third son of Lord Quellyn Greyjoy. Where his brother was handsome and dashing, Victarion was a bit plainer and a little calmer. During the Greyjoy Rebellion, Victarion had been the muscle behind Euron's plans to burn the Lannister fleet at Lannisport, but he was subsequently defeated by Stannis Baratheon at the Battle of Fair Isle. Victarion held a lifelong hatred for Euron as a result of Euron's alleged rape of his wife. Victarion could be reviewed as something of a traditionalist. He honored the quote-unquote old ways. If he was elected king, Victarion planned to continue the campaign in the North and consolidate Ironborn power in the region. And so, with these two brothers as being the two leading candidates of the King's Moot, the King's Moot was finally held. Several captains presented gifts and made their own case for the kingship, but they proved to be less than popular. When it came to Victarion's turn, he presented his own unique gifts. While these gifts were well received by the Ironborn, Euron had something unique in store for the Ironborn. Quote, "Sharp as a sword thrust, the sound of a horn split the air. Bright and baneful was its voice, a shivering hot scream that made a man's bones seem to thrum from him from within. The cry lingered in the damp air. A feast for crows, the drowned man." After the horn was sounded twice more, Euron and his mongrel band of followers and bastards marched forward. Euron's appeal to the Ironborn was bold, so bold that it broached madness. Euron promised the Ironborn the entirety of Westeros. Many doubted his claims, but he had a mad plan. Daenerys Targaryen and her dragons. The horn that was sounded would bind the dragons to Euron's will. The Ironborn would take Westeros, and they would do so with Dany's dragons. But first, Euron had another target in mind. Returning back to Slaver's Bay, let's talk a little bit about Yunkai now. South of Meereen, Yunkai was stirring. Though Yunkai had suffered a defeat at Dany's hands, the city had not been taken by Dany's army. Instead, it agreed to peace with Daenerys as long as it ended its slave trade. However, as soon as Dany's army moved on, Yunkai resumed its slave trade and began to rearm for the war against Daenerys. Yunkai's casus belli was similar to the Sons of the Harpies. Daenerys threatened the livelihood of Yunkai, and while they had made claims that Daenerys had been the aggressor and their cause merely defensive, Yunkai's true aim was to restore the slave trade in Slaver's Bay. What I kind of find interesting about this is why Yunkai decided to move against Daenerys. Did they fear that Dany would return to destroy their city? If so, she wasn't taking an active role to prepare for war against them. While noting Yunkai's preparations early in A Dance with Dragons, Dany didn't seem inclined to ride out against Yunkai despite their violations of the peace accords. Quote, King Cleon would be wise to attend his gardens and let Yunkai tend theirs. A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 1. Even more strange, the removal of Astapor and Meereen from the slave trade essentially gave Yunkai an economic monopoly in slave trading, one that would likely make them fabulously rich compared to their neighbors. But those are questions for another time, and I don't actually, even now, a year later, I still don't know the answer as to why Yunkai just decided to start warring on Meereen. Regardless, Yunkai was preparing for war against Meereen. Now, the Yunkish army was comprised mostly of slaves. Yunkai wasn't simply preparing internally for war against Daenerys. The city was hiring sellsword companies for their campaign. Quote, an envoy from the Yellow Cities in Volantis, even now, hiring swords. The Long Lances have already taken ship for Yunkai, and the Windblown and the Company of the Cat will follow once they have finished filling out their ranks. A Dance with Dragons, the Merchant's Man. Now, the Windblown were a sellsword company whose origin lay in Pentos. The founder of the Windblown was a man who went by the name of the Tattered Prince. Originally elected to the position of the Prince of Pentos, the Tattered Prince opted to flee the quote-unquote honor and fight as a sellsword. Years later, he started his own sellsword company. The Windblown mustered about 2,000 soldiers for the campaign in Slaver's Bay, with mixed heavy lance and foot soldiers. Historically, they had a fierce dislike of the Company of the Cat on account of them being on opposite sides of a battle and a war in the disputed lands. The second sellsword company was the Company of the Cat. Led by a man who only went by the name of Bloodbeard, the Company of the Cat was comprised mainly of 3,000 infantrymen. They hated the Windblown, and Bloodbeard in particular hated the Tattered Prince. The third sellsword company was the Long Lances. The Long Lances were a smaller mercenary company that was primarily a mounted force of about 800 heavy lancers. They were commanded by a guy who kind of looked like a shoekeeper named Gylo Regan. But to subdue Meereen, Yunkai needed more than sellswords and their own slave army. To this effect, Yunkai made alliances with other cities. Quote, when the Wise Masters move against Meereen, the legions of Nugis will fight beside them. Telosi, Illyrians, even the Dothraki. A Dance with Dragons, Tyrion 6. Nugis would bring 6 legions, about 27,000 soldiers, and 100 armored elephants to the fight. They were convinced to join with Yunkai on the shared belief that Daenerys threatened the Giscari way of life, that is, slavery. Karth would be the next city to join with Yunkai. Initially, Daenerys believed that they would be allies of Daenerys on account of her previous relationship to the city. But Karth had seen the destruction that Daenerys and her dragons could bring to the city. The Warlocks were a powerful faction within Karth, and that sworn vengeance on Daenerys for her past actions in Karth. Additionally, Karth traded in slaves, so there was a common cause for Karth and Yunkai to ally against Daenerys. The initial overall commander of this confederation was a Yunkish man named Yurkaz O'Yunzak. Yurkaz was an old man, and his tactical and strategic acumen were not well regarded by his fellows. Still, he commanded a massive host, and this host would march, but Meereen would not be its first target. Another more tempting prize presented itself to Yunkai and her armies. Back in Meereen, Dany's inability to understand the goals and motivations of the Sons of the Harpy were having serious consequences. Holed up in her pyramid, Dany was trying desperately to learn how to govern a foreign city whose key movers and shakers hated her and her ideals, and it was not really going that well. The insurgency was growing bolder and more violent. In evaluating Daenerys' attempts to quell insurgency, I think it's helpful to know more about successful counterinsurgency principles. Granted, these are modern standards, but they help to understand why Dany's early efforts failed. To simplify successful counterinsurgency principles, I turn to Lieutenant Colonel David Kilcullen, who developed the three pillars of successful insurgency. The first pillar is security. Military, police, human, public, and population security encompass this pillar. The people in a counterinsurgency environment should be made to feel safe as well as actually kept safe by the occupation government. In Meereen, Daenerys and her band of conquerors failed to secure the environment following the conquest of Meereen, leaving an unstable security situation in the eyes of all the Meereenese. The second pillar is political. Mobilization, government extension, institutional capacity, and social reintegration. Organic political organizations will need to grow up apart from the occupiers. Early in A Dance with Dragons, political authority rested entirely in the hands of Daenerys, though as we'll see, she did attempt to decentralize the political arrangement of Meereen with varying degrees of success. The third pillar is economic. Humanitarian assistance, developmental assistance, resource and infrastructure management, and growth capacity. As previously seen, Daenerys uprooted slavery, the single pillar of Meereen's economic structure. Other trades would take time to develop in Meereen. In the place of the slave trade, a serious economic vacuum existed. With the security situation of Meereen worsening, and Dany's army of Unsullied unable to maintain order, Dany turned to uncertain allies within Meereen itself. While unwilling to cede too much political power to Meereenese citizens, Daenerys created something resembling the Small Council of Meereen. This council would advise her on political and security matters within the city. One of the first people she selected was Reznag Mo Reznag. He was an older Meereenese noble. He acted as Dany's seneschal, that is, an officer in the royal court who conducted domestic affairs and arrangements. This is essentially a combination of a royal secretary and chief of staff. Distrusted by Barristan and Skahas and even Daenerys, Reznag consistently was a voice for peaceful, measured action of Meereen, and this council would earn Reznag's suspicion of him being in league with the Sons of the Harpy. One of the second people involved was a woman by the name of Galaza Galer, or the Green Grace. She was the high priestess of the Temple of the Graces in Meereen. Like Reznag, she advised Daenerys to seek peaceful options within Meereen. I'll get more into her in subsequent parts, but her words in council echo rhetoric used by the Sons of the Harpy, leading some, including me, to believe that she was the Harpy itself, that is, the great commander of the Sons of the Harpy. The third person is Histar Zolorek. He was one of Meereen's wealthiest citizens and was a strong proponent of reopening Meereen's fighting pits. Histar was an additional voice for peace within Dany's small council, and as we'll see in subsequent parts, would come to play a major role in Dany's attempts at peace. Finally, Skahas Mokandak was a Meereenese noble who broke with his former Qaskari identity and became the leader of the Shadepates, namely, those who had shaved their heads as a symbol of their defiance of the old ways of Meereen. Skahas, or the Shadepate as he became known, became a voice for harsher measures to deal with the insurgency, while the Shadepates acted as something like an indigenous colonial police force. So what are we to make of Dany's policies in the early parts of A Dance with Dragons? Should we view her initial policies of counterinsurgency in a positive or negative light? Well, I think it's a little bit of both. Starting out with the bad, Dany does do a deed, which I've talked about in another essay series and recording called The Dragon's Mercy, where she allows the torture of the wine seller's daughters to bring names after a particularly heinous crime. I won't bring that up again other to say than that probably wasn't something that brought about the love of the people for her. But in other matters, Daenerys was headed in the right direction. While the Unsullied were unable to affect stability in Meereen, Daenerys had the loyalty of many of those she had freed in Astapor, Yunkai, and Meereen. These men and women were known as the Freedmen, and they were intensely loyal to Daenerys, and they were willing to fight either in the pits of Meereen or in service to her. Quote, "The Freedmen had been a rabble once, but once she had organized the men of fighting age into companies and commanded Grey Worm to make them soldiers." So basically, she had taken these guys, and some women as well, and had organized them into kind of free companies of fighting men, and they were all being trained by the Unsullied. Now, Barristan Selmy was also doing good work in service to Daenerys. He had devised a plan to recruit freedmen and former pit fighters into Dany's army and train them to be knights. But Barristan's boys were only about 26 strong, and they really weren't knights in the traditional sense. Quote, "Some of them had been fighting in the fighting pits when Daenerys Targaryens took Meereen and freed them from their chains. Those had had a good acquaintance with sword and spear and a battle axe, even before Sir Barristan got a hold of them." Finally, Daenerys attempted to quiet the fears that many Meereenese had with regard to her dragons. After Drogon killed and ate a small child, Dany had ordered her dragons chained up. The Unsullied were able to capture two of her dragons, Viserion and Rhaegal, and chain them inside the Great Pyramid of Meereen in a makeshift dragon pit. However, Drogon, her largest and most fearsome dragon, eluded capture. Now, this was a really good measure for Daenerys in her counterinsurgency campaign. She was providing, when we talked about the pillars of counterinsurgency, she was providing the appearance of security as well as actual security. And though the dragons have been instrumental in her conquest of Slaver's Bay, they were less than ideal when it came to peacefully ruling a city. Removing two visible symbols of Daenerys' conquest of Slaver's Bay was a pretty important propaganda move by Dany. More than being a good measure by Daenerys, it kept the dragons from burning and killing all... More than being a good measure by Daenerys, it kept the dragons from burning and killing at will within the city of Meereen. Now, as an aside, Dany's actions in Meereen are somewhat reminiscent of what coalition forces in Iraq did, when they instituted the surge in 2007. The Americans stopped using armored tanks in day-to-day operations so as to remove a visible symbol of violence in the eyes of the Iraqis. Though tanks were used in major operations during the Iraq War, most coalition soldiers traveled in vehicles that weren't as aggressive appearing, and it minimized their appearance as being seen as aggressors by the Iraqi civilians. But even though Dany was doing good in Meereen, she couldn't bring stability to the city quickly enough. With instability on the rise and Yunkai regrouping, time was against her. Daenerys and her followers needed a more permanent solution to end the insurgency of Meereen and halt Yunkai's military advance, however unpleasant any permanent solution would be to Daenerys personally. So we've set the stage with Meereen, Yunkai, Astapor, and the Ironborn. So let's conclude this part of the analysis with talking about the war between Yunkai and Astapor. With Yunkai gathering swords, Astapor looked a likely target on account of its weakness. Cleon needed Dany and her dragons and her army to be a shield and sword against Yunkai. And Cleon wasn't wrong about Yunkai's intent. Yunkai's ultimate aim was to unseat Daenerys and restore the historic social order of Slaver's Bay, particularly that of the slave trade. But first, Yunkai had to clear the path to Meereen. The Yunkai couldn't march on Meereen with the thought that Astapor could seize the opportunity and march in from behind to lay siege on the city of Yunkai itself. And so, the course was set. Yunkai would march first on Astapor and then on Meereen. After Yunkai had accumulated the necessary sellswords and felt that its own military strength was sufficient, the city marched on Astapor with all its might. In desperation, Cleon tried to fight the Yunkai. Quote, "The time has come for Astapor and Meereen to end the savage reign of the wise masters of Yunkai, who are the sworn foes of all who live in freedom. Great Cleon bids me to tell you that he and his new Unsullied will march soon." A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 1. But Cleon's new Unsullied weren't proper Unsullied. They were the sons of former slavers in Astapor and did not have the intensive, brutal training regimen of true Unsullied. In contrast, Yunkai had many veteran sellswords and soldiers under its banner. Battle was finally met at a place called the Horns of Hazzet. Little information about the battle itself is provided in Dance of Dragons, but suffice to say that Cleon and his quote-unquote Unsullied were soundly beaten by Yunkai's army and fled back to Astapor. What happened next was nothing short of butchery. Pursued by the Yunkish army back to Astapor, Cleon quickly found himself and the city he ruled under siege. In his final move, he ordered the remnants of his shattered army to sally out to attack Yunkai's siege lines, but his men refused and killed the Butcher King instead. Quote, "We have heard that the Butcher King of Astapor is dead, slain by his own soldiers when he commanded them to march out and attack the Yunkai." A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 4. In Cleon's place, a new king rose for a time, but he was quickly cut down as well. Quote, "The words were bitter in her mouth. He was hardly cold before another took his place, calling himself Cleon II. That one lasted 8 days before his throat was opened. Then his killer claimed the crown. So did the first of Cleon's concubines, King Cutthroat and Queen Whore, the Astapori call them. Their followers are fighting battles in the streets while the Yunkai and their sellswords wait outside the walls." A Dance of Dragons, Daenerys 4. With people dying in Astapor and new rulers rising and falling, Dany could have jumped to try and save Astapor, but she was unwilling and unable to send aid. Cleon had violated Dany's anti-slavery policy in Astapor, which in Daenerys' mind likely placed him in the same league as the slavers in Yunkai. Furthermore, Dany couldn't send aid as Meereen's internal stability was being contested by the Sons of the Harpy. If she marched on Astapor, she ran the risk of having Meereen revolt behind her. Quote, "And whilst you are raising Yunkai, my sweet, Meereen shall rise behind you. Do not close your eyes to your peril, Daenerys. Your eunuchs are fine soldiers, but they are too far to match the hosts that Yunkai will send against you once Astapor has fallen." A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 3. But though Daenerys decided rightly to remain a Meereen and not come to Astapor's aid, the entire episode could have been prevented. Had Daenerys left the force of Unsullied in Astapor, she could have kept her council alive and prevented Cleon's ascension. Moreover, good Unsullied would have likely been able to hold Astapor at least for a time. As Tywin Lannister put it once, one man on the wall is worth 10 underneath it. So regardless of whether the fiasco could have been prevented, Danny's decision to stay on Meereen would have profound consequences for the city of Astapor. When an Astapori envoy arrived at Danny's court in Meereen begging aid, the only aid that Danny would offer Astapor would be in the form of volunteer freedmen. The envoy's response both showed the helplessness of Astapor's situation as well as foreshadowing its fate. Quote, "We are all dead then. You gave us death, not freedom." A Dance with Dragons, Daenerys 3. Within the city of Astapor, things were growing even more desperate. Warring factions within the city were fighting in the streets while mass starvation and disease began to set in. Yunkai's armies lay outside the city, letting the inhabitants within the city tear each other to pieces. They also helped the slaughter along. Quote, "The Red City was the closest thing to hell he would ever know. The Yunkai had sealed the broken gates to keep the dead and dying inside the city." A Dance with Dragons, The Windblown. Finally, in desperation, Astapor's last ruler, known as Queen Hor, ordered a general attack on Yunkai's siege lines with the last of her unsullied. In a last desperate attempt to rally Astapor's soldiers, Queen Hor had Cleon's corpse armored and mounted on a horse. And despite the fact that Astapor's unsullied weren't true unsullied, when they marched, they were able to break through Yunkai's slave soldiers. But this initial glory was not to last. The Windblown and the Company of the Cat were able to attack on the Unsullied's flanks and rout their army. And when the Unsullied attempted to flee back to Astapor, they met a cruel fate. Quote, "The new Unsullied threw down their spears and shields and ran, only to find the gates of Astapor shut behind them." A Dance with Dragons, The Windblown. Thus, all the Unsullied died outside the walls of Astapor, and the city was quickly taken and sacked yet again. The slaughter in the city was great. Queen Hor died in the fighting. Others were staked into the ground or thrown to starving dogs. Those Astapori who survived and emerged from the chaos fled the city. The survivors were terrified, homeless, and worst of all, suffering from a plague known as the Bloody Flux. Yunkai ordered its armies to keep the Astapori refugees away from Yunkai itself, and thus there was only one place for these refugees to flee. With Astapor destroyed, Yunkai and its armies turned to its true target, Meereen, and Daenerys Targaryen.